It's September 4th, 2003. This is Andy Mushin. I'm with Martin Jack Rosenblum in his home in Shorewood. We'll be talking about his life that began in Appleton, Wisconsin.
Began in Appleton, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm.
And how did your family get there, and when did they get there?
My father was born in Sweden and immigrated to this country by falsifying his age, such that he could come over before he would otherwise have been permitted to do so. Mm-hmm. And this would have been, he was born in 1903, mm-hmm. same year the Harley-Davidson motor car.
Oh, that's right.
Founded.
Yeah.
And he came over in the teens. When he was in sixth grade, he left school in Sweden mm-hmm. to be a peddler with his father and brother. And he decided, my father decided that the only way, and he served in the military service in Sweden, the only way that he was ever going to make anything of himself was to come to America. So there was some age requirement, and I don't understand that precisely, but he definitely came over in the teens, very young, and moved into the Wisconsin area because there was a relative, mm-hmm. and then met my mother, who was from Appleton, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Her mother came from Poland. Her father came from Russia.
I see.
They met in Chicago, moved to Appleton, Wisconsin, where they opened up a tailor shop.
Hmm.
And my mother, of course, living in Appleton, met my father at a dance, a Jewish dance, in Green Bay. Moved to Appleton when they got married,
mm-hmm.
and opened up a ladies' ready-to-wear store, as it was called at the time. And then was drafted into the American Army during World War II, so he served in two armies.
Oh, boy.
Moved back to Appleton after his service in World War II, where he forever remained.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was your father's name?
Sander, S-A-N-D-E-R.
Uh-huh, Rosenblum.
R-O-S-E-N-B-L-O with an umlaut over the O-M, mm-hmm. Rosenblum.
Uh-huh.
But it was changed to R-O-S-E-N-B-L-U-M at Ellis Island.
I see. And what was his father's name?
Moritz, mm-hmm. R-O-S-E-N-B-L, umlaut, O-M.
Do you know where in Sweden they lived?
Yes, Göteborg. And then they moved to Stockholm. And my father and my mother and I went back to Sweden in 65, which was the first time that my father had ever been back to Sweden since he left.
Hmm.
And we were able, he was able through memory, to, after getting his bearings, find his original tiny little house in Stockholm where the whole family lived. It was him, two brothers who both also immigrated to this country, neither of whom lived in Appleton.
Mm-hmm.
One lived in Michigan, and one who was rather a philanderer, moved around the country constantly, and his sister forever stayed in Sweden. So my father was the only one of the family who moved to Appleton and remained there.
Mm-hmm. And how did his family get to Sweden? I hear so little about Swedish Jews.
It's very interesting. It's a very interesting question. My wife did an extensive genealogy, and all of my relatives on my father's side have forever, as far back as could be researched, were from Sweden. So the answer to your question is, that's the only thing we've ever been able to come up with.
Now, you've mentioned Stockholm, where the house was, but also Göteborg.
He lived in Göteborg for quite a while before ultimately, at a very, very, very young age, moving to Stockholm, which is where he grew up.
Mm-hmm. Is that G-O-T-E-B-E-R-G, or do you know how to spell it?
It's actually Gothenburg.
Yeah. You know, an odd thing, there was a rabbi in Appleton in the 1990s who had served in Gothenburg.
Really?
Seriously. And I'll think of his name after I turn off the tape. But
my mother, who still lives in Appleton, would probably have known
right,
who that
was. Walkoff. His name was Walkoff.
Yes, I remember her.
And he moved south. But he was
there
for a few years. Yeah.
I remember her mentioning the name.
But for Appleton to have two Jews who lived in Gothenburg, that's incredible.
It is.
When you think about it.
It is. When you think about it, it is. And our synagogue, Moses Montefiore, was actually founded by a number of people, including my grandfather, Harry Ressman, my mother's father. Because I remember on his lapel, he had a little pin that said, you know, I bought a brick for Moses Montefiore.
Wow.
And if you paid money to build, you got a little pin. That synagogue is still standing, although it's a Baptist church now. At least it was the last time I was in Appleton, a Baptist church. And the Moses Montefiore Synagogue was where I went to Cheder, where I started in third grade. And that's where Rabbi Gilbert Silverstein was the rabbi, as well as the Sunday school teacher, and of course, Cheder. He taught Cheder as well.
What years did you live in Appleton?
I was born in 46, and I lived there until 66. Then I moved to Madison, Wisconsin to complete my doctoral work, and then moved to Milwaukee in 1970 to teach at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee.
I see. Now, tell me again, if I think I forgot, what year did your father arrive in Appleton?
It's very unclear.
I see.
The teens.
The teens, And he was, he came to the States for essentially economic opportunity?
Absolutely.
And what did his father do back in
Sweden? He was a peddler. He had a horse and buggy and traveled the countryside with my father and my father's older brother. And they would accrue items and sell items as they traveled.
So your father came as a young, very young man through Ellis Island.
Yes.
And did he go directly then to Appleton?
No, he moved to Iron Mountain, Michigan first, where there was a very distant relative, and opened a business there, and also opened a business in Chicago and commuted between the two. But there was an anti-Semitic police officer who knew my father's travel route and would always give him a ticket for speeding on Sunday night. And my father told me the story of letting the anti-Semitics, the police chief's wife, who was also anti-Semitic, but my father had a ladies dress shop that was quite, you know,
is this an Iron
place.
Mountain? Or,
this is an Iron Mountain. Let her run up a bill. Gave her credit. And as he told me, the credit got into the hundreds of dollars. And he finally, after traveling from Chicago to Iron Mountain to keep two stores going and continually on a Sunday night, getting a ticket from this very anti-Semitic guy, called the police officer and his wife in and said, this amount is owed, and the husband didn't know that the wife had run up such a bill, and my father took the bill and tore it up and threw it away and said, will I see you on Sunday nights now, or will I not? And he never got another ticket.
Wow.
That's a true story.
That's a great story.
And he told me that as an example of how to behave as a Jew. Now, the moral of the story is not to get something on someone, but to behave in such a way as to not make an issue of being Jewish. And there are pros and cons to this story. This moral is very meaningful to me. The pros to it are you succeed by virtue of being smarter. And coming up with a scheme that was pretty interesting, actually.
Yes.
And the downside is that you don't stand up.
But in a sense, he was the bigger man in that he forgave.
That's how I look at my father as the bigger man.
Yeah.
I'm taking a step back, and I'm being philosophical here. But in the end, I look upon him as the wiser, bigger man in the situation because he never got another ticket. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, the police officer would escort him into town on Sunday nights.
Oh, my goodness.
This is a true story.
That's great.
Isn't that a wonderful story?
It is. I love that story.
That's marvelous.
So what year do you think this took place? He was a very young man in those days.
Very much a young man. Very enterprising young man.
Stores in two cities that far apart.
In two cities that's far apart. And he hired someone to manage the store in Chicago. Well, what happened to the store in Chicago is that it was approached by the mob for insurance. Mm-hmm. You pay insurance, your store is going to be okay. So he closed it ultimately. And it almost at the same time met my mother at a dance in Green Bay. At which point he then also closed the Iron Mountain, Michigan store and moved to Appleton, where he started all over again in a clothing store, same business, but had married my mother, whose parents had a tailor shop. So my father had a clothing shop, and my grandfather and grandmother in their tailoring shop did all of his alterations.
Oh, good business.
The tailor shop was on Appleton Street in Appleton, Restman's Clothiers. And my father's ready-to-wear shop was on College Avenue, and it was called the Rose Shop.
R-O-S-E?
R-O-S-E.
Do you know why he chose Rose?
Well, his nickname was Rose.
Oh.
Everyone called him Rose.
Well, that makes sense.
Rose and Bloom. Mm-hmm. All of his friends called him Rose. No, I've never heard anyone call him Sander. It's always Rose. Hey, Rose.
That's great. Ressman, how is that spelled?
R-E-S-S-M-A-N.
And how long, or how did the Ressmans come to Appleton? Do you know that story?
They met in Chicago and actually fell in love. That would be Sarah Spector and Harry Ressman. Spector from Poland, Ressman from Russia. And why they moved to Appleton to open a store, as it was told to me, was they had heard about it as a place where there might be opportunity, and literally got on a train and came to Appleton and started a business.
Incredible. And when would that have been, do you think?
It would have had to have been in the 30s. Mm-hmm. It would have had to have been in the 30s.
Now, it's interesting that your parents from these two small towns kind of met in the middle at a Jewish dance in Green Bay.
Yes.
Did they ever talk about that dance?
Do you know? As a matter of fact, I have a letter. When my father passed away, all of his worldly possessions were in one box and it amounted to photographs from Sweden when he was young, army photographs from his Swedish service and his American service, and a letter he wrote to my mother when he met her in Green Bay. And it started out, "Dear Esther Ressman, I am the young man who had the privilege of sharing a dance with you at," and then he goes on to describe the dance in Green Bay, "and I would love to see you again if I may please call upon you."
And did he have to ask her twice? Or?
No. But one thing that was interesting is that he fell in love with her immediately. And he didn't propose to her until he had $1,000 in the bank.
And that was his own kind of
internal
rule?
That was his own internal rule.
So how long did that take for him?
My understanding is it was about a year of courtship until he got $1,000 in the bank. And at that point, he felt that he could propose.
In Appleton, did his store do well? Did the Rose store
do well?
Yes,
it did. It did exceptionally well. Yes.
And did he have any incidents like with the police chief and his wife?
I remember one that was very interesting that was not quite as remarkable as that. But we were next door. I started working for my father in third grade. Cleaning the basement, washing the windows, doing errands. And I remember one Saturday going next door to a restaurant, and there was someone who we would call homeless today. a hobo
mm-hmm.
who ordered a huge meal and couldn't pay for it. And the owner of the restaurant was about to call the cops. And my father reached in his wallet and took a $20 bill out, which was a lot of money then,
mm-hmm.
put it on the table, told the owner of the restaurant, who was a friend of his, because obviously it was right next door, this pays for this man's meal and as many more meals as the tab will permit.
Mm-hmm.
And he slammed his fist on the counter and walked out. And he turned around to me and he said, you know, if you're Jewish, you must be generous.
Very interesting. Was he a religious man and an observant
Very.
Man? Very. Uh-huh. So he went to shul often?
Yes.
Daily or weekly? Or?
He went not daily because work came before religion.
Mm-hmm.
He would go Saturday mornings.
Mm-hmm. And then would he open the store on the afternoon?
He would have someone. He would have someone else open the store Saturday morning.
Uh-huh.
He would not close.
But did he go in at all on Saturday morning? On Saturday to work?
Yes, he did.
He did.
Work came before religion.
Yeah, but he made sure to go to shul.
Absolutely.
Too. Was he the kind of guy who would put on tefillin? Do you remember that?
He did for many, many, many years, and gradually uh-huh. stopped.
Uh-huh. How many languages did he speak, and what did you hear around the house?
What I heard was a mixture of Swedish, Yiddish, and English.
I'd like to hear a Yiddish-Swedish accent. That would be interesting.
There's nothing like it. I wish I were. I wish I could imitate language, you know, accents.
Uh-huh.
It was the Yiddish had a Swedish accent. The English had a Swedish accent. They both, you know.
Mm-hmm. So, in addition to the way he spoke, was there anything else Swedish about him?
Oh, very. He uh-huh. was extraordinarily formal. He would cut the lawn, for example, on weekends in a three-piece suit.
Serious? I'm sorry
yeah.
to laugh.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
I'm thinking of Green Acres when I
yeah.
hear
no,
that.
Yeah, no, he had a handkerchief in the pocket that matched the tie, and he'd uh-huh. be pushing the hand more. He worked 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the Swede in him. Swedes are exceptionally conservative and formal people.
Mm-hmm. Did it filter into his politics, too, if I may ask? Do you remember him as political at all?
He was very political. As a matter of fact, Joe McCarthy used to play cards down the street from us.
That's right. He was from Appleton, wasn't he?
Yes, at Judge Van Susteren's house.
Uh-huh.
And my father one day took me out and put his arm around me and said, son, there goes a true American.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. When did you realize your father was maybe mistaken?
In the 60s.
Mm-hmm. So was that the Swede in him who respected
yes.
you know, authority? You think?
Yes. Yes.
Wow. So did he know Senator McCarthy, or he just knew
no.
him?
No. Uh-huh. No.
Okay. Tell me about the Jewish community, as you remember.
The Jewish community was very close-knit, and Moses Montefiore was Orthodox.
Mm-hmm.
My bar mitzvah was an Orthodox bar mitzvah.
Mm-hmm.
I studied from third grade. I was bar mitzvahed at 13. I was young for the year of school I was in. Was it sixth or seventh grade?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was seventh, because I should have been in sixth, but I was young for my school year. The rabbi, for example, had a broken leg and, of course, had to walk to the synagogue, and there were a chain of people carrying chairs, so he would walk X number of feet, and a chair would be put down for him, and then he would stand up and walk further, and the chair would be put down for him.
That is unbelievable.
I know. That was for my bar mitzvah. As a matter of fact, he made a record at the local radio station because he couldn't see me for my lessons often enough for my Haftorah. And so he made which I still have.
He recorded your Haftorah?
Yes.
Wow.
Which I still have. Yes.
78 or?
Yes.
That's really neat.
I still have that.
Yeah.
At WAPL in Appleton.
Uh-huh.
And so
I've never heard of that.
I know. Yeah. I studied from that record because he was in a great deal of discomfort when I was getting into the final mm-hmm. stages of study.
Because of the leg? Or,
yes, yeah. yes, yes, yes.
What happened to him? Do you remember?
No. Oh. He retired, and I believe the last I heard, I had left the faith, and I'll tell you why. I had left the faith before he left Appleton, actually. I was bar mitzvahed. I taught Hebrew school I taught Hebrew for religious purposes. I taught for at least 3 or 4 years after my bar mitzvah. Mm-hmm. But one day, I encountered something called the Holocaust in a book. Mm-hmm. No one talked about it. And I went to Rabbi Gilbert Silverstein and I said, how did this happen?
So you really had never heard of it until you were 16 years old or something?
It was around 15.
Uh-huh. 15. Do you remember which book, if I may ask?
No, I don't. Okay. It was an American history book. Mm-hmm. I said, explain this to me. And he said, it was the will of God. And I said, no, it was not the will of God. It was the failure of people to fight back. And I walked out, and I have never gone back.
To any synagogue?
Correct.
I see.
I'm a firm believer in the Second Amendment to the Constitution. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, there was a seminar at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee on Jewish education that I was invited to. This would have been in the 80s. And somehow it drifted into pacifism and how Jews must be pacifists. And I stood up and I said, I disagree. And I explained in very erudite terms, not maniacal terms, mm-hmm. Not NRA terms, mm-hmm. How the Second Amendment to the Constitution is especially important to Jews. And I was told that I was degrading the memory of those who died in the Holocaust. And I said, excuse me, you are degrading the memory of those who died in the Holocaust if you do not own a weapon to protect your family. And they asked me to leave.
Wow. My goodness. So this is in the 80s,
yes,
at UWM.
Yes. And when I did not get a satisfactory answer to that question, at that age, something took over, mm-hmm. and it has not changed since then.
It's interesting.
Culturally, I consider myself to be Jewish.
Uh-huh.
I have been brought up in the Jewish tradition of scholarship. I'm an excellent scholar. Mm-hmm. I have studied, of course, the Talmud. I have a Talmudic way of thought. The poetry that I write actually is very much influenced by a group of Jewish writers called the Objectivist Poets, who began writing in 1939. It was started by a very serious Jewish poets, and I'm considered to be a neo-Objectivist poet. My music, mm-hmm. very much influenced by the sounds of the prayers, the melodies. I have a song called Down on the Spirit Farm on one of my albums that mm-hmm. really is very close to one of the melodies that I had to learn to be bar mitzvahed. Mm-hmm. The music I write is very influenced by it. The words, I ultimately began to study the Kabbalah. Mm-hmm. That was my only way of staying in touch with Judaism, because I was not going to be involved with mainstream Judaism after that experience.
With your rabbi.
Correct.
It's interesting. I mean, you could have gone to a rabbi who would have had a different explanation. Do you think your life would have been different? I did.
I went to Rabbi Twersky here in the city.
The older man? Or
the younger.
The younger. Michal.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I went to him and I asked him the same question. I got the same goddamn answer.
Yeah.
And I said, excuse me, I have to leave now.
Uh-huh.
And he said, well, I'm sorry. I said, do not apologize to me. This was my attempt to come back into the faith. I really wanted to, and I was hoping mm-hmm. for a different answer. It wasn't God's will. It was mm-hmm. the failure to fight back.
Interesting. Because you could find rabbis now, and I'm not recruiting, but I'm saying you could find rabbis now. Who'd say it? But okay.
Thought I was going to pull a gun out, didn't
you? No, I didn't. I won't tell you what I thought you were going to pull out. I can't say it.
Listen, the Holocaust was not beshert. It's part of suffering. Mm-hmm. There's a suffering mentality mm-hmm. that I absolutely refuse to have anything to do with. Mm-hmm. It's part of the faith. And it is inappropriate.
Did you ever belong to the Jewish Defense League or any such organization?
They weren't radical enough for me.
They weren't radical enough for you. Uh-huh.
I'm an anarchist. I belong to no organizations.
I see.
I don't even recognize the United States government. Mm-hmm. I'll pay my taxes because I don't want to get in trouble.
Uh-huh.
Of course. I don't want to get in trouble. But I don't recognize anyone's right to tell me to do anything at all to any extent whatsoever. I think the United States government is here to regulate economics and to make sure that our food sources are safe, which they're doing a very bad job of.
It's true.
And I see no other reason for it to exist except to defend our shorelines.
Mm-hmm.
My job is to defend my home. That's not the job of the local police department. If I come down and there's someone in my living room, what am I going to do, call the cops? Excuse me.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If I'm living in Germany at that period of time and I'm watching what's going on around me, I refuse to accept the fact that people didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's part of the faith that you're going to suffer. And I refuse the faith because of that element. And I found it when I was young with Rabbi Silverstein, and I found it when I was older and tried to come back with Rabbi Tversky.
So you're saying the belief system is that Jews, our destiny is to suffer, our fate is to suffer, and we just have
to accept
it. Yeah.
Not to me, but
no.
It's taught.
Uh-huh. This is an interesting path you've taken for a guy who grew up as an Orthodox Jew in Appleton, Wisconsin.
Yes, it is.
Uh-huh. Were there indications earlier in your life that you would go off in the non-Orthodox direction, so to speak?
Perhaps, if I think back, uh-huh. because I always had a leaning toward rockabilly, which I was playing, and of course, I became a beatnik instantly.
Yeah.
And I was part of the folk blues revival. I guess, you know, if I go back before that, I think about my early interest in the Old West and the honor code and the idea of self-preservation and that you do lay down your life for your family.
Mm-hmm.
You do. And you do lay down your life for principles if necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found in Judaism is the opposite.
Okay. I want to just, before we explore this a little further, there were a couple of details I wanted to ask you about.
By the way, I only have Colt pistols, and they're all single-action cowboy guns. I am not equipped with fully automatic or semi-automatic weapons.
Yeah, I was going to say, your bomb shelter is very well hidden.
I have a prized 1902 Colt that I shoot regularly, and I'm very good.
Where do you shoot?
A friend's farm.
Uh-huh.
I'm actually an expert marksman.
Mm-hmm. Do you hunt?
No, I do not.
Uh-huh. You just target shoot.
I buy my food. I do not go out and kill animals for food.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If I had to, I would, but I don't have to.
Mm-hmm. All right, I want to get back to a little bit of the detail of Jewish life, and then we'll get back to some of these other things.
As we get back to it, I felt that I had to conceal my Judaism when I was growing up in Appleton. After school, in third grade, when I would go to cheder, I would never tell anybody where I was going.
Mm-hmm.
I was very self-conscious. There were only two Jewish kids in my class.
Which school did you attend?
I attended what was then Edison Elementary School.
Mm-hmm. Near your house?
Walking distance.
Mm-hmm.
And that was another lovely thing. My grandmother and grandfather lived through the ravine on one side, and my aunt and uncle, my mother's sister and her husband, lived through the ravine on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very lovely, idyllic childhood that I experienced, and I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. And it was very much based on Judaism, the holidays. Sunday always was spent at my grandparents' house with both families. It was a very close-knit family.
Mm-hmm. Do you have siblings?
I'm an only child, and my mother's sister had only one child.
I see.
And the Jewish community was very interactive. It blended in by day, but not by night. And, you know, I sort of really didn't know what to make of being Jewish because I was hanging out with all these, you know, blonde Nordic morons and who thought throwing a football around was life. And I never could quite understand it. So I turned to rockabilly music and I turned to poetry. And again, as I said, the folk blues revival is where I really blossomed and began to perform regularly. And I played
in Appleton, or
yes, there's a huge scene because of Lawrence University.
Oh, sure.
I played with Lightning Hopkins.
Wow.
I played with Sleepy John Estes. I played with John Lee Hooker.
Incredible.
Yes, I played with Libba Cotton, who wrote Freight Train, who was the Seeger maid. And I played with Mike Seeger, and I played with Pete Seeger. I played with the New Lost City Ramblers. I played with the Butterfield Blues Band. I sat around with Michael Bloomfield, and we talked about our Jewish upbringing and how it brought us to the blues.
Well, he grew up in suburban Chicago.
Absolutely.
A wealthy kid, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. I spent quite a bit of time with him.
That's for another tape, I guess. I'm very interested in that. You went to Cheder, you were saying.
Yes.
I've got to get back to this stuff.
Yes.
How often did you go? I mean...
I went twice a week.
For how long? Hour or two?
Hours.
Hours, yeah. Did it seem like weeks or days? Or?
I love the melodies. I love the melodies.
So you were taught prayers and...
It was an oral tradition.
Yeah.
I mean, I had the book. But it was an oral tradition, and I was taught by the rabbi... he would sing the tune and I would mimic it, and I learned it orally.
How many kids were in your Cheder class?
Four.
Boy. And were you close with them?
No.
Why not, do you think?
They weren't hip.
I see. So even at
they didn't know who Gene Vincent was.
But I'm talking.
They never heard of Little Richard.
Okay, you were 9 years old though when you went to Cheder, you know.
Absolutely, and I was listening to Little Richard, and
yeah, that would be 1955. Yeah. About
yeah. Okay. And Gene Vincent was my idol. I saw him at the Rainbow Ballroom in Appleton.
Wow.
And none of these other people in my Cheder class, they're all good little boys, and I didn't feel like a good little boy, but yet. I was really dedicated to them, and I certainly, you know, would not ever be disrespectful.
No, and you taught kids like this.
Yes,
later
I did.
On, you were saying.
Yes, I did.
This sense that you didn't really fit in. Did your father feel that way too, or did he not have the luxury even to think about those?
He didn't
questions?
Have the luxury to think about those questions.
He had to make a living, right?
Yes, yeah. I'll never forget walking into a store one day. Doesn't bother you.
No.
Walking into his store one day, and he was down on his knees measuring. He had a woman's ready-to-wear store.
Yeah.
He had health issues. He closed it. Sold it, actually. Then opened up a men's ready-to-wear store because he couldn't stand retirement. And I walked in, and he was measuring the pants length of a very waspish, wealthy man of repute in the community, who was treating my father like a servant. And my father was going, yes, sir, no, sir, yes, sir, no, sir, and measuring the suit. And then, of course, it would go over to my grandfather's shop for alterations. And I took a look at that, and I thought, I understand you, speaking about my father. I understand you. I know why you're doing this, but I can't handle it. And it really upset me. He didn't have the luxury of rebellion. And when the man, when the sale was done and the man was fitted, he thanked him profusely, and the guy treated my father like he was nothing. And my father remained a perfect gentleman throughout. But there was a look on his face that I'll never forget. He didn't say anything.
Do you think it must have been a number of emotions? I mean, anger, disgust, any self-pity that he was stuck in?
No self-pity, absolutely none. I never saw self-pity in my father ever. I saw a sense of personal integrity being violated.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did your father hung out with his Jewish friends, it sounds like, at night? I mean, and on weekends?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. He was a member of the Masonic Temple, as a matter of fact.
Oh, that's interesting. And
isn't that interesting?
Lots of Jews have done that.
Yes.
I mean, here in Milwaukee.
Yes. And he wore his ring proudly. Mm-hmm. Another thing in the box of possessions I inherited. He had many Jewish friends. As a matter of fact, only Jewish friends.
Mm-hmm. Was he a part of B'nai B'rith?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And was he active in it?
Yes.
Or he did? That's interesting. Did he raise money or
yes.
he must have given money? He did
yes.
all those kind
yes.
of typical
yes.
Jewish things.
Yes, definitely.
Uh-huh. So you and you were. What about your mother? Did she was
Ladies
she
Aid Society? Uh-huh. Yes.
So she would go to synagogue. Too?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Now in those days, were the men and women
yes.
seated separately?
Yes.
Okay.
Definitely
uh-huh.
with a black curtain.
Were the women in back or on the side?
They were actually off to my left in the back.
Uh-huh. And you sat with your dad, or
yes.
Uh-huh. Could you still daven if you
yes,
felt
I could.
The need even?
Yes,
though,
I could. I do remember it all. Yes.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't do it without covering my head. And
well,
I tell you, yes, I can't do that. And as a matter of fact, we have Passover. And when it comes to the prayers, I can't participate because I either would want to do it the right way or just eat well.
But you tell the story.
Yes, it's all in English.
Yeah.
I do not. It is a cause of... My wife would prefer that I would daven and do the prayers,
mm-hmm.
but I do not.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever think you'll go back? I'm just curious, and I know it's a very personal question.
It's a very personal question. We discussed before we turned the tape machine on that I'm tattooed and couldn't be buried in a
yeah.
Jewish cemetery.
Uh-huh.
So if I went back, I couldn't go all the way back, could I? Yes, I think I will.
Well, that's fascinating.
Through
because
the,
it hasn't
through,
left you.
I think I will go back through the Kabbalah.
Uh-huh. Now, the Kabbalah can bring you back to Rabbi Twersky, and it can bring you back to...
No, it can't bring me back to Rabbi
okay.
Twersky. He's got a community, and he has no sense of mysticism. He's a fine man. I have a lot of respect for him,
mm-hmm.
but the man is not mystical.
All right.
My sense of Judaism is based on mysticism.
Mm-hmm.
It's not based on, for example, we were invited over to... some friends who are a member of the Twersky community. And I walked in the house and I, you know, to the wife said, hello, which I shouldn't have done.
Yeah.
And I just forgot. And it was the most horrible thing that could have happened. And I felt like saying, you can take the supper you're about to give me and shove it. If that has anything to do with God, mm-hmm. there's something wrong with you. My sense of Judaism is mystical. It's very deep inside of me. It will be with me forever. And yeah, I think I probably will return to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have returned to it through my art. I'm just not calling it Judaism yet.
Well,
I think I will someday call it that.
I'm anxious to read your poetry now.
In that book, which is mm-hmm. the least important of any book I've ever written,
oh,
but
okay.
but the one that...
Well, then thanks for giving it to me.
It's the only one left that I've got copies of
I see.
Because it was a bestseller.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, it's got the logo on it that
sure.
made it the bestseller.
Mm-hmm.
And it has its moments,
mm-hmm.
and I think you'll recognize them. It has its moments where I'm talking about what I'm talking to you about. And I think you'll see them in there.
Mm-hmm.
Why I say it's the least interesting is that it is the least spiritual.
Mm-hmm. When you walked out of the rabbi's office back in Appleton, how did your parents react to your...
They defended me. The rabbi came over to my house and said, "This is terrible. What's going on here?" Mm-hmm. And my father basically asked him to leave. He said, "My son can do whatever he wants to do. Mm-hmm. If this is how he feels, this is how he feels." Now, my father was very complicated. He didn't want me to play guitar. You concentrate on your education. If you're starting to play guitar, you're going in the wrong direction. You have books that you need to learn from. Mm-hmm. Yet, the only day off he ever took in his entire life was to drive to Milwaukee to buy me my first good guitar.
That's a wonderful story, too. He was a devoted father, wasn't he?
Yes.
Wow, that's lovely. Did that encounter your father had with the rabbi affect his relationship with the rabbi?
Yes.
Or with the synagogue?
Yes, it did.
Uh-huh.
I noticed a change after that.
And the change was what?
Well, ultimately, he got around to basically saying to me, "You know, it's turning into a bunch of people who are showing off their mink coats on Saturdays. I don't think I'm going anymore."
My goodness.
He quit. He stayed at home and prayed.
He did, though. So he was individually still a religious man.
Absolutely.
They kept kosher?
He stopped that, too.
He stopped that. Hmm. How old was... So?
By then, I was in high school.
Uh-huh. Okay, so that's about 1960. So he was in
The whole thing took a while to evolve. By the time the description of my father I just gave you was in place, it would have been 62 or 3.
Mm-hmm. What year did your parents die? What years did they die?
My father passed away. I woke my wife up in October of 88. I woke her up at 3 in the morning and I said, "My father's going to die today." And she looked at me. We've been married 33 years. Mm-hmm. And she said, "Why don't you go write a poem?" I said, "No, Maureen, this is different. My father's going to die today." And she said, "It's 3 in the morning." Mm-hmm. I said, "My father's going to die." She said, "Go write a poem. Go write, mm-hmm. You know, go, this is," and I settled down and I thought nothing of it. And my father called the next morning and we talked every Sunday morning. And at 3 o'clock that day, I got a call from the neighbor that he died.
My goodness. Wow. He was in Appleton at the time?
Yes.
You were here in Milwaukee?
Right. And I went to Appleton, of course, to bury him. It was obviously an Orthodox funeral. And you don't open the casket, obviously, which I did. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a message to him on his burial shawl and closed the casket, said goodbye to him. We got to the cemetery and the rabbi said, "I will now speak." And I said, "No, you will not." And I spoke. And I thanked my father for misunderstanding me. I thanked him for not really being able to come to grips with the fact that I had this artistic sensibility. Mm-hmm. Because by virtue of his lack of support of it, although he did, didn't he, take mm-hmm. one day off to buy me a guitar, it strengthened it. And I thanked him for being one of the most generous people I'd ever met in my entire life, not only to his family, but to everyone, mm-hmm. and to being a man of integrity. And the rabbi moved forward to say Kaddish, and I said, "Thank you, I'll say Kaddish." Mm-hmm. And which I did, saying it appropriately, and the rabbi grabbed the shovel and I took it out of his hands and shoveled all the dirt in myself. Mm-hmm. And the community of hundreds was taken aback.
Hmm. So you remember the reaction as you were doing all this? Or?
One of respect, actually, not anger.
Yeah. It's a hard thing to...
I expressed tremendous love for my father while I was doing this. Mm-hmm. Tremendous love for him.
And many of the people he knew in Appleton were able to attend the funeral.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Jews and non-Jews?
Yes. He was very well respected. Uh-huh. Yes.
As a businessman, and it sounds like as a human being.
Absolutely. There were people that did owe him money. And I remember as a little kid going, he would go collect it at night, go to their houses and say, look, you know, you got to pay your bills. Well, I can't afford it. And he said, well, you know, just give me something. And I remember one night, for some reason, a $25 bill, he took 10 bucks. He said, fine, we're done. And the funeral was one of joy for me because I had a mystical experience that showed me my father's death before it happened. So when it happened, it was perfectly normal. I never shed a tear. It was supposed to happen. My father and I were unconsciously linked. Uh-huh. If you believe in Jungian thought, psychophilosophy, I knew it, and so therefore it was okay.
That's interesting. Have you felt that way about other deaths?
No.
Was your mother alive at the time?
She's still alive today.
She still is.
Lives in my boyhood home. And will not leave. She's much too old to be there by herself, but she will not leave.
Yeah, that's the story of a lot of older people.
1220 East Pacific Street. She will not leave, and I will not sell the house. What I'm going to do with that home when my mother does pass away, she's 90, is empty it. And I'm going to use it as my retreat.
I see. Your own personal retreat?
Yes.
Or retreat for
my own personal retreat.
Is your boyhood bedroom still intact in the house?
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
Everything is as I left it when I went off to college. I went to the Fox Valley Center for 2 years because I was working at my father's store and he needed my help.
Were you a salesperson or what?
Yes.
Did you do?
Uh-huh. And I'll never forget one day I was waiting on a customer and I brought out some Thai tacks and I had three of them on the counter. And when I turned around, there was only two. The guy stole one. Mm-hmm. And I went up to my father. I said, I'll be right back. I said, he said, did you see him do it? I said, no. He said, well, then forget it. I said, how could I do that? I know he took it. He said, forget it. You didn't see him do it.
Wow.
And I didn't know what to do. And of course, the guy, you know, ultimately said, I don't want anything. He left. And I said, Dad, can I go out for lunch? My dad said, sure, yeah, you can take a lunch break. I followed that guy. All the way down Wisconsin Avenue. We're talking that far behind him. He kept, you know, I never said a word. I just followed him all the way until he got into his car. And as he got into his car, I was...
right up to the window?
I didn't touch him.
No.
My father wouldn't have liked that.
I see. You were a good boy, weren't you?
Well, as the book I gave you describes this mythopoetic character, I believe in doing a little wrong to do a lot of right.
So I hope he never stole, this guy never stole anything again. I'm sure he didn't go
back. I never saw him again.
Yeah, I was going to say that. It's never in your store.
And I hope he enjoyed that damn tie tag.
Okay. All right. Tell me about some of the other Jewish people in your family's life. And you and I have talked about that you knew my great uncle, Manny Zussman.
Oh, he was such a wonderful person. He pretended to be a mean guy and nasty, but he was the nicest guy in the world. As a matter of fact, all the juvenile delinquents hung out at Zussman's.
This was a grocery store?
Yes.
And where was
all
it?
All the bad boys hung out. It was on Pacific Street right before Lemonwall Bridge. All the juvenile delinquents were there, the motorcycles, the hot rods, because a guy named Bill Riley lived behind it, who was a hood. And every hood in the city of Appleton was at Zussman's buying penny candy. They didn't steal anything from him. They really didn't. You assume they would.
Yeah, yeah.
No.
So they were hoods, but they actually paid for their candy.
And drank from the Coke machine out front. Uh-huh. And once in a while, there would get to be too many of them out there. And he would come out, and he always wore a white apron, and he'd chase them away. He says, "You guys are blocking this." Because a lot of the old Jewish women would shop there, mm-hmm. my grandmother included. Mm-hmm. So he would come out and yell at them and really get angry and chase them down the street. But he really, it wasn't, I mean, he was yelling and screaming and chasing them, but he wouldn't hurt anybody. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
I remember one time he came out with a squirt gun and squirted everybody.
That's pretty funny.
One guy who was really mean, Tim Strutz. I mean, he was a hood who was a psychopathic hood. Challenged Mendy. He said, you know, used profane language. He said, "I'm not leaving. I'm going to finish my Coke." And Mendy did push him away from the store physically. And Tim backed off and left.
Interesting. How old was Tim?
Tim was a year older than me. 14, 15, 16. Uh-huh. Somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Probably 14 because I was around 13.
I remember Mendy as kind of a husky guy.
Very.
Yeah.
And his best pal, Abe Shilkrat, would hang out there all the time. Abe was a bachelor. And him and Mendy would always go to the back of the store, and Helen, hired help, Goyim, would take care of the store, and him and Mendy and Abe Shilkrat would go, and I don't know what they were talking about, but they were laughing and patting each other on the back. I don't know. I think they were telling dirty jokes, honestly.
Yeah, just hanging out at the back of the store.
Yeah, and actually, interestingly enough, Abe's brother was a very well-educated man, a teacher, a school teacher, who refused to work on Saturdays. And got fired from the Appleton public school system.
Wow. What kind of Saturday work was there?
Coaching. And so he opened up a junk business and was a peddler.
What did Abe Shilkrat do?
A peddler.
He was a peddler. Wow, a peddler. Because that's, we're talking...
A rag man.
The 50s we're talking about.
Scrap metal. I Bacall. Yeah. Scrap metal.
Who are the other Jews you remember? Was there a mush... Was there a working shochet in town? Because my great-grandfather was a shochet, at least in his earlier years.
No, came in from Milwaukee.
I see. So for many years, that's how your parents got their meat? They drove in and got it, or someone else drove
Someone came in. My grandmother actually raised chickens in her backyard, and this guy would come in once a month.
When you went to services, you know, on Shabbos, or how many people were there, for instance?
I remember quite a number.
Yeah? Older people or all ages?
All ages. I remember 50 to 75, 80.
On Shabbos?
Yeah.
Men and women?
Yes.
And kids?
Yes.
Oh, very interesting. And this was this sort of the everyone prays on their own kind of place, the davening?
Yes. Yes, definitely. And as a matter of fact... there was a number of old, very, very interesting men who would really go off on their own. And Rabbi Gilbert Silberstein, toward the end of my involvement with Judaism, would ask them to stop. And I was starting to get angry. He shouldn't have asked them to stop. And I started, before the experience I told you about, I was starting to lose a sense of Judaism as being a place of mysticism. Because this man was having a religious experience. Why are you asking him to stop? The congregation actually at that point split. And the real Orthodox people began to have their private ceremonies in a little house near the synagogue. And I don't remember the name of the man who led that community. But he wasn't an ordained rabbi. Well, as you know, anyone can be a rabbi. But it split. And the real Orthodox, by this time, had moved into this little house down the street from Moses Montefiore.
Oh, that's interesting. How long did that
I don't know.
Meet? All right.
But I would walk by, and I would be very interested in it.
Never went in?
No, I never went in. I wanted to. It was a little yellow house. I could go there today. I know exactly where it was.
So it belonged to one of the people?
Yes, it did.
And I imagine there was a Torah in there?
I don't know.
Oh.
I don't know what was in there.
Interesting.
Maybe a Colt 45.
Sure. And then Moses Montefiore eventually became a conservative synagogue, officially capital C conservative.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then built out by Playman Park, this huge, god-awful looking McDonald's-type synagogue.
But every community was doing that pretty much at that time.
Absolutely. That's absolutely. And by then I was long gone.
Right, you were long gone.
Yeah.
Is there anything else? I know we're getting to the point where we need to finish soon. Anything else?
One more story.
Okay, good. I like your stories.
My father told me a story when he was a peddler with his father. They were camped at a little town, and it was sundown Saturday. So they would stop working. Mm-hmm. Sundown Friday and camp wherever they would be in the countryside, the Swedish countryside. And they wouldn't work Saturdays. But it was sundown Saturday, and he asked if he could go into town to a dance. How old could he have been? Gosh, he must have been 13, 14, 15. Mm-hmm. And it had been a bad rainstorm that day, and it was very wet, and his father said, well, you know, I'm worried about, you know, it's dark and you got to go through the woods to this little town. My father said, it'll be all right. And he remembered leaving the camp with his father and his older brother and walking into town, going to the dance and walking home and having religious thoughts. Mm-hmm. My father was a very religious man in the moral sense of the word. And also in the sense of godliness, too. They're different. And suddenly there was this little old woman walking toward him on this path. And the path was very narrow. He described it as being 2 or 3 feet with a gully on each side filled with water and then the woods on each side. And in order for them to pass, they had to grab one another under the elbows and literally go like this.
Huh. Help each other turn. Yeah. Past one another.
And my father thought, that's strange that there would be a little old lady out tonight. Mm-hmm. And less than a second, he tells me, he turned around and there was no one there.
Oh, man. Wow.
And I wrote a book about that story. And
how did he interpret that?
He interpreted that as something that no one will ever understand. And he said it to me, he told me that story in a conversation we were having about how some things in life are never to be understood. They're simply to be experienced, and there's never going to be a way to know ultimately what it's all about. Mm-hmm. And he used that as an example.
So he understood, in a sense, your interest in mysticism, didn't he?
I guess he did, didn't he? Yeah,
sounds like it.
Yeah. I guess he did. He was it was a very paradoxical thing. Mm-hmm. He wanted me to fit in, but I was a juvenile delinquent and a beatnik and a rockabilly mm-hmm. guy with sideburns and greasy hair, and that was, mm-hmm. you know, he said, what are you doing with those payas, you know? Because they weren't the real ones, you know? And yet, he had this side to him that would tell the story of this woman. He took the day off to buy me the guitar. Mm-hmm. I think that he understood that as a Jew, there were certain things you must do, but that there was another life that was really your own.
And I don't mean to end on this, but you've mentioned a couple times you were a delinquent.
Yes.
How bad were you? What did you do?
I was quite bad.
Yeah? Stole things?
Yes. Including a car, in which I got caught. Mm-hmm. And I was an embarrassment to my father for about 2 years.
Was it an embarrassment for the Jewish community as a whole?
That's
a shanda for the goyim?
That's yeah, precisely. Uh-huh. That's how my father put it.
Interesting.
That's how he phrased it.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't worried that I broke the law. I mean, that was a terrible thing. Mm-hmm. That was a terrible thing. And he certainly was not pleased. But he was more concerned about the image of a Jew who would be doing what I was doing. I mean, I really fell in with people who thought they were James Dean and were acting out Rebel Without a Cause. And I was bad. And what straightened me out was the discovery that the Beat Poets were also nonconformists, thieves, drunkards, and
junkies.
Yes. And I never in my whole life have been involved with drugs. But during this period of time, I hated alcohol. I'm not a drinker either. But I certainly did drink, just to get the feeling of being drunk and going out and taking cars and, you know. But the issue was that it was to my father. The issue was that a Jewish boy does not do this. That was the only issue. And that I would be an embarrassment to the community because I'm Jewish in doing this. I mean, of course he was upset that I was doing it.
Of course, yeah.
But that was a small part of the anger. The major part of the anger was you're Jewish and you're doing this.
But he forgave you?
He absolutely forgave me, and had he not, I probably would have continued longer.
I see. Very interesting. I guess we'll stop here. This has been so fascinating, really interesting, and thank you so much
for
sharing your life and your history.
Thank you. Your questions are really insightful and have led me into actually revisiting things that are very important to me. So it is I who thank you.
Well, my pleasure, and you're welcome.